Hi, I'm Matt Payne, and welcome to 20th Century Revolutions. Episode 2.30, The Fall of Rumelia, The Balkan Wars, Part 1. Last time, we followed the events of late 1911 and early 1912 as an opportunistic Italy forced a war upon the Ottomans in an effort to claim Libya. As we saw, the Ottoman government proved wholly unprepared for this invasion, and the Italians quickly occupied key towns along the North African coast. But then, in response to the invasion, CUP officers under the leadership of Ismail Enver organized an informal guerrilla war in Libya, and this insurgency proved highly effective. Enver, Mustafa Kemal, and other Unionist officers led Ottoman soldiers and volunteers, Senussi sheikhs, and Bedouin nomadic tribesmen in an asymmetric conflict that dragged the Italo-Turkish War on for much longer than the Italians had anticipated, and nearly bankrupted them in the process. But then, in an effort to break the stalemate in North Africa, the Italians expanded the conflict into the Eastern Mediterranean and the Aegean. As the Ottomans were fending off this existential threat to the heartland of the empire, the CUP government under General Mahmoud Shevket was toppled by a coup. This coup was organized by a coalition of liberals, lower-ranking military men, and Albanian leaders, under the leadership of a group calling themselves the Savior Officers. Following the Savior Officers' coup, the government was taken over by an allegedly nonpartisan government dubbed the Great Cabinet. In reality, this government was largely under the thumb of the liberal and anti-CUP Freedom and Accord Party. But still, in order to strengthen national unity, the Sultan appointed as Grand Vizier the aging military hero Ghazi Ahmed Muhtar Pasha, who was viewed as a non-party man. So, going into the fall, the CUP was out of power. But the war with Italy was beginning to look very, very grim, and it seemed only a matter of time until the new Ottoman government would surrender. CUP officers like Enver called for a continuation of the war in order to salvage Ottoman honor. However, following the Italian seizure of strategic islands in the Aegean and bombardments of Ottoman ports in Anatolia, the Ottoman position became completely untenable. But before a final peace could be secured, the worst fears of Ottoman diplomats suddenly came true when Montenegro declared war on the Ottoman Empire on October the 8th, 1912, and launched the First Balkan War. So, the good news for us here on this podcast is that we have already covered the background of the Balkan Wars in quite a lot of depth. And honestly, I'd say about, what, half of the episodes thus far could be considered as a background to the Balkan Wars. But if you're just dropping into this episode specifically and want more info on how we got here, a good place to start would be the episode on the Bosnian Crisis, episode 2.25, as well as our series on the Macedonian Struggle, episodes 2.16 through 2.18. Then, if you want to go even further back, listen to the series on Bulgarian unification, episodes 2.4 and 2.5. And finally, for the long durée history of the Ottoman Balkans, essentially the entirety of season 1 will get you covered. But for a very quick rundown, so that we can understand the greater significance of the Balkan Wars within the broad sweep of history. The Balkan League that would declare war on the Ottoman Empire in 1912 was made up of Bulgaria, Serbia, Greece, and Montenegro. All of these nation-states, with the notable exception of tiny Montenegro, were at one time or the other a constituent part of the Ottoman Empire. For centuries, the Balkans were a vital center of the empire's political, economic, and military life. And among many reformist elites, especially the Young Turks, Rumelia, which is what they called Ottoman Europe, was viewed as the empire's most progressive and dynamic region. In contrast, eastern Anatolia, North Africa, and Greater Syria were viewed by the Young Turks as provincial backwaters, as peripheral territories to be ruled, almost like a colony administered from the imperial metropole in Istanbul. the veneration of Rumelia would persist right up until the outbreak of the Balkan Wars, and arguably long after the wars had ended. Nearly all of the most important Unionist leaders during and following the revolution were from Ottoman Europe. Enver grew up in Monastir. Mustafa Kemal had been born and raised in Salonika. Talat was from Edirne and spent most of his formative years in Salonika. Ahmed Niazi was from the Monastir province. Ahmed Jamal had been born on the island of Lesbos and would, like Talat, Enver, and Mustafa Kemal, spend much of his life in Salonika. And these are simply the most prominent figures in the CUP, but the pattern continues through the ranks of the party. As we talked about in our episodes on the Young Turk Revolution and on the Action Army, the revolution was in many ways a Macedonian and Albanian phenomenon, as officers, guerrilla bands, and volunteers rose up throughout Rumelia to overthrow the traditionally entrenched powers in Istanbul. So, the revolution was driven in large part by actors from Ottoman Europe, who sought to modernize the empire in line with Rumelian ideals of reform, cosmopolitanism, and military professionalism. The fact that the revolution's home was in Rumelia matters because the Balkan Wars would be, more than anything else, a life-or-death struggle for control of Ottoman Europe. The major battles would all be fought in the birthplace of the revolution, in Macedonia, Thrace, Albania, and Kosovo. And the eventual loss of Rumelia would stamp the CUP's policies and drive the Unionists away from the utopian idealism of 1908 and towards the bitter realism of 1913. As Enver would declare following these wars, quote, "I am prepared to gladly sacrifice the remaining years of my life to take revenge on the Bulgarians, the Greeks, and the Montenegrins." So, we cannot fully understand the brutal nature of the CUP dictatorship without first understanding the magnitude of defeat and the catastrophic loss of life, property, and dignity as a result of the Balkan Wars. So, let's dive in. Knowing what we know about Balkan politics, it might seem initially surprising that Bulgaria, Serbia, and Greece managed to form an alliance in 1912. Because for decades, these three nations had been engaged in that brutal, irregular war known as the Macedonian Struggle. Ever since the 1878 Congress of Berlin had left the Bulgarians in control of a rump principality instead of an independent Greater Bulgaria, which they had been promised, Bulgarians had aggressively infiltrated Macedonia through the building of schools and churches, through the smuggling of weapons, and at times, through direct military involvement. Moving into the 20th century, Greece and Serbia had also joined in on the fun, as they began to informally support guerrilla bands in the region and to build their own churches and schools. All of these efforts were meant to win the allegiance of Macedonian peasants, who were, more often than not, quite indifferent to nationalist movements and tended to identify most with their religion. So, when Macedonian Christian communities aligned themselves with Bulgarian, Greek, or Serbian bands, they tended to do so for practical reasons. They sought protection and education, and it was only after developing relationships with band leaders, teachers, and priests that Christian peasants in Macedonia began to feel any sort of allegiance to the neighboring nations of Bulgaria, Greece, or Serbia. Nationalism in Macedonia was not a natural phenomenon, but was forced upon the population through education, religion, and violent conflict. The Macedonian struggle peaked with the Ilinden Uprising of 1903, when massive revolts broke out across Macedonia and Thrace, when Christian communities rose up against Ottoman rule. As had happened countless times before, this revolt was brutally suppressed, and the violent retribution led the great powers of Europe to intervene on behalf of Macedonian Christians. The Ottomans were then forced to enact reforms, and great power representatives were stationed throughout the region. These reforms forced upon the Ottomans only ever had the effect of worsening the situation, as the great power meddling led Ottoman leaders to feel resentful and created a volatile environment for everyday people. This great power meddling was the precipitating factor that led to the outbreak of the Young Turk Revolution in July 1908. And quite tellingly, it was only after the revolution and the re-establishment of the constitution that the Macedonian struggle began to finally dissipate, demonstrating how a homegrown Ottomanist movement was much more capable of ending violence in the region, as opposed to great power interventions, which tended to only make things worse. During the heady days of July 1908, leaders of Christian guerrilla bands turned in their weapons and declared their loyalty to the constitution. Bulgarian and Greek priests embraced in front of cheering crowds to symbolically mark the end of the Macedonian struggle, the end of violence in Ottoman Europe. But then, beginning in late 1909 and running parallel with the Albanian revolts in Kosovo and Albania that we talked about in the last two episodes, there would also be a marked increase in violent unrest in Macedonia. Many Bulgarians, Greeks, and Serbs had initially embraced Ottomanism, the constitution, and the CUP following the revolution. Christian guerrilla leaders, such as the Macedo-Bulgarian Jan Sandanski, had specifically told his followers to remain loyal to the Ottoman constitution and to ignore the appeals of leaders over in Bulgaria proper. However, once the authoritarian tendencies of the Unionists were laid bare for all to see, the Macedonian struggle would begin once more. And if you can believe it, it would become even more brutal. So, the Christian guerrillas who had laid down their weapons in 1908 would pick them back up in 1910. These guerrilla bands would play an important role in the war that is to come, and almost as a rule, these guerrillas would join up with their respective nation-states. Even Jan Sandanski, who had been the foremost supporter of the constitution and of Ottomanism, would fight alongside the Bulgarian army during the war. So, by 1910, Macedonia had returned to its normal state of violent tension and constant irregular warfare. The rivalry over Macedonia had prevented the emergence of an alliance between Greece, Bulgaria, and Serbia for decades. But after the Young Turk Revolution, the interests of the Balkan states began to align, and as usual, an initial driving force behind the formation of the Balkan League were the Russians. As we know all too well, the Russians had been deeply involved in nearly every major event in the Ottoman Balkans, really going all the way back to the 18th century. Greek independence had been won in 1830, only after the Russians defeated the Ottomans in a great power war. The same was true of Serbia and Bulgaria, who only won their independence and autonomy respectively following the Russo-Turkish War of 1877-78. So, Russia maintained significant influence over the Balkan states, especially Serbia and Bulgaria. Now, we shouldn't overstate this, because, as we saw during our series on Bulgarian unification, the Balkan states never behaved like the obedient Slavic children that the Russians wanted them to be. The Bulgarians went ahead with unification in 1885, and then with full independence in 1908 without consulting the Russians. And then Serbian loyalty often flitted back and forth between the Russians and the Austrians. And then for the Greeks, they often looked towards Great Britain as their great power patron, though the Russians and the French were also heavily involved in Greece. What this all means is that the real defining characteristic of the foreign policy of the Balkan states was one of shifting alliances. Bulgarian, Serbian, Greek, and Montenegrin diplomats became masters at playing the interests of one great power off of another. The Bosnian crisis of 1908 would fundamentally change the nature of Balkan diplomacy and set the stage for the Balkan League. In October 1908, Bulgaria declared independence and Austria annexed Bosnia in rapid succession. The immediate impact of the Austrian annexation was that Serbia nearly declared war on Austria because the Serbs viewed Bosnia as part of Greater Serbia. The Serbs had hoped that Russia would back them in their confrontation with Austria, but the Russians, recently weakened following their defeat against Japan, could not take on the Austrians in 1908 in a great power war. So, two important developments would happen in Serbia following the Bosnian crisis. First off, Serbian diplomats began to lose confidence in Russia's ability to defend their interests against a newly aggressive Austria. And then second, the Russians became sensitive to this loss of confidence, and they began to do everything they could to rebuild the relationship with Serbia and to assure their Serbian clients that next time the Russians would get their back. This would be critical during the July crisis of 1914. In Bulgaria, the Russians had been furious that the Bulgarians had declared full independence without asking them first. As a result, Bulgaria began to distance itself even more from Russia. And in the short term, both Serbia and Bulgaria began to feel that it was important for them to develop their own foreign policy, independent of any great power patron. But this push for diplomatic independence in Serbia and Bulgaria remained a tightly held secret until the outbreak of the Balkan Wars in 1912. And even though Russia did not openly encourage war against the Ottomans, Russian diplomacy following the Bosnian crisis was essential to precipitating this war. The central figure here was the Russian ambassador to Serbia, Nikolai Hartvig. Hartvig had been sent to Serbia in 1909 following the Austrian annexation of Bosnia in order to quote-unquote manage Serbia. Essentially, the Russians knew that the Serbs were extremely angry, and they didn't want Serbia to do anything crazy, like start a war in the Balkans. But if the Russians were hoping to prevent a Balkan conflict, Nikolai Hartvig was about the worst person they could have sent to Belgrade. Hartvig was more than anything else a radical pan-Slavist, and he was fervently anti-Austrian. It was often said of Hartvig that he was more Serbian than the Serbs. So, just like his pan-Slavist predecessor from the 19th century, old Count Ignatiev, Hartvig would often act independently of the Russian foreign ministry. And just as it happened leading up to the Russo-Turkish War of 1877, the official Russian position in the Balkans was often in contradiction to the actual policies being implemented on the ground by Nikolai Hartvig in Belgrade. So, on his own initiative, Hartvig began to negotiate between the Serbs in Belgrade and the Bulgarians in Serbia in an effort to form an anti-Austrian alliance bloc. The foreign minister of Russia, Sergei Sazonov, was not wholly opposed to a rapprochement between Serbia and Bulgaria, but Sazonov was opposed to any major territorial changes in the Balkan status quo. Hartvig disagreed with Sazonov here, and as a radical pan-Slavist, Hartvig wanted both Serbia and Bulgaria to expand their territories at the expense of the Austrians and the Ottomans. So, Hartvig acted with considerable autonomy and often exceeded the caution of the Russian foreign ministry, which sought to guide Balkan diplomacy without sparking a regional war. So, the Russian ambassador, Nikolai Hartvig, often acting independently of the foreign ministry, would lay the groundwork for an alliance between Serbia and Bulgaria. By 1911, leaders in Belgrade and Sofia were showing signs that they were ready to come to some sort of agreement. Then, the precipitating events that would ultimately push the Bulgarians and the Serbs to finalize their agreement came with the outbreak of the Italo-Turkish War in September 1911, and with the widespread revolts that broke out across Albania and Kosovo. The Italo-Turkish War proved that the Ottomans were overextended and vulnerable. The Albanian revolts also demonstrated Ottoman weakness, but even more important, the rise in Albanian nationalism created fear amongst Serbian and Bulgarian leaders. Both Serbia and Bulgaria sought to eventually control territories that held large populations of Albanians. For the Serbs in particular, Kosovo had long been the mythscape of Serbian irredentism. The Kosovo myth, or Kosovo cult as it is sometimes called, was the central narrative within Serbian nationalism. The Serbs had long felt that it was their destiny to control Kosovo. Of course, the trouble here was that Kosovo had a majority Albanian population. So, if nationalism gained momentum amongst Albanians, it might mean the future creation of an autonomous Albanian province in the Ottoman Empire, or even worse for the Serbs, an independent Albania with the backing of a great power patron. So, with all of these events swirling, the Bulgarians and the Serbs finally came together in spring 1912. And on March the 13th, a secret Serbo-Bulgarian alliance was formed. The specifics of this agreement are critical in understanding the events to come. As was to be expected, the terms of this treaty specifically focused on Macedonia. In the agreement, Macedonia was divided into three zones. The north and northwestern portions of Macedonia would be annexed by Serbia. The southern and southeastern zones would be annexed by Bulgaria. The central portion of Macedonia, in between the Bulgarian and Serbian zones, was left as a contested territory. And it was decided that Russia would eventually arbitrate a future agreement. And ultimately, the Tsar would be the one who got to decide who controlled central Macedonia. Nikolai Hartvig advised Bulgarian and Serbian diplomats during these negotiations and assured them that Russia would guarantee the treaty, even though the Russian government was much more hesitant. The treaty also outlined a joint military operation in the event of a war against the Ottomans. Both Bulgaria and Serbia pledged to mobilize their armies and to coordinate offensives, with Bulgaria agreeing to send soldiers into Thrace and to threaten the Ottoman capital of Istanbul, and Serbia promised to focus their offensive in Macedonia and Kosovo. The presence of the Serbian army in Macedonia and the absence of the Bulgarians would become critical in the aftermath of the First Balkan War, because the Serbs and the Greeks would simply lay claim to Macedonia for themselves, boxing the Bulgarians out and laying the groundwork for the Second Balkan War. But now we are beginning to get ahead of ourselves. In the months following the Serbian-Bulgarian alliance, Greece and Montenegro would also secretly hop on board. In May, Greece signed a military alliance with Bulgaria, though this alliance did not include any sort of specific post-war territorial divisions, mostly because both Bulgaria and Greece wanted to claim southern Macedonia for themselves. Then Montenegro was already closely aligned with Serbia. Its king, Nikola I, had close dynastic ties with the Serbian royal family and shared strong political sympathies. So by summer, Montenegro had also committed to coordinate their military efforts with the three other Balkan countries. Montenegro wanted to claim northern Albania and the Sanjak of Novi Pazar, which was the small strip of Ottoman territory lying in between Montenegro and Serbia. So, with all four countries laying claim to pieces of Ottoman territory, the Balkan League epitomized the aggressive irredentist nationalism that had come to define the region's politics. Bulgaria, Serbia, Greece, and Montenegro all viewed their territorial claims as a God-given right ordained to them by their nationalist mythologies. But it is very, very important to remember that these territories claimed by the Balkan League had been under Ottoman control for hundreds of years and held very, very diverse populations. So many Muslims, especially Muslim Albanians, had long lived in these areas now being claimed by the Christian nation states. During the course of the wars, the Balkan countries will conceive of their invasions as a liberation, but in reality, it will be a conquest of Ottoman lands that will prove catastrophic for the everyday people of Macedonia, Kosovo, Albania, and Thrace. It is quite telling that the event that would ultimately push the Balkan League to reveal itself and to declare war on the Ottomans was the success of the Albanian revolts. As we mentioned last episode, many Albanian-Ottoman troops had refused to suppress the revolts in 1912, and some even defected or deserted. This contributed to the collapse of Ottoman control in the region, and the loss of Albania and Kosovo was one of the most important factors behind the Savior Officers' coup, which temporarily removed the CUP from power. By August 1912, Albanian rebels had seized key cities across Kosovo, including the regional capital of Pristina, and briefly entered Skopje, the administrative and military hub of Ottoman Macedonia. These gains underscored the rapid weakening of imperial control in Albania, Kosovo, and Macedonia. In response, the new government under the great cabinet of war hero Gazi Ahmed Mutar in Istanbul issued a decree granting the Albanians all of their demands. So, this meant the allowance of Albanian language schools, the selection of Albanian local officials, a local Albanian gendarme police force, and partial self-government. Essentially, it looked as though Albania was about to win autonomous status within the Ottoman Empire, just as Bulgaria and Serbia had once done. An autonomous Albania was extremely threatening for the Christian nation-states of the Balkan League, because it would directly threaten their territorial ambitions, which included the entirety of this proposed Albanian state. If an autonomous Albania was created by the Ottomans, and most importantly, if this new Albanian state was accepted by the great powers, the irredentist claims of the Balkan states would potentially be lost forever. So, Serbia, who had already been boxed out of controlling Bosnia by the Austrians, began to feel that they had to do everything they could to prevent the formation of a greater Albania that might cut Serbia off from the Adriatic coast and from controlling northern Macedonia and Kosovo. Serbian leaders concluded that they needed to claim Macedonia and Kosovo now, while the Ottomans were still vulnerable amidst the war with Italy. So, in late September, Serbia called for a general mobilization. Montenegro, who was closely aligned with Serbia and harbored their own ambitions in northern Albania and the Sanjak of Novi Pazar, also began preparing for war. Greece remained initially hesitant, partly due to unresolved disputes with Bulgaria and uncertainty over naval coordination. Bulgaria, by contrast, was already preparing a major offensive into Thrace. Meanwhile, as the Balkan states prepared to strike, political tensions in Istanbul reached a boiling point. The Ottoman state was now being led by a cautious civilian government that had sidelined the Committee of Union and Progress during the Savior Officers' coup. But the CUP had not disappeared. Instead, it reemerged in the streets, rebranding itself as the voice of patriotic defiance and resistance. Mehmed Talat, recently driven from power, became the leader of this wave of CUP agitation. Both Talat and Mehmed Javid, the two most powerful unionists who had held government ministries, had both been forced underground during the Savior Officers' coup. Throughout the summer of 1912, Talat and other CUP hardliners presented themselves as true Ottoman patriots, willing to sacrifice for the fatherland in ways that the new and cowardly government was not. And then, as tensions with the Balkan states grew throughout the fall, Talat and the CUP would attempt to capitalize on the crisis atmosphere by making populist appeals to Ottoman Muslims, who were understandably afraid of a Serbian or Bulgarian invasion. On October the 4th, Talat and other leaders of the Sacred Committee organized a large demonstration in Istanbul, just down the street from the Sublime Porte. Talat, Dr. Nazim, and others gave fiery speeches to the crowd, and the demonstration ended with Talat waving a large Ottoman flag and shouting, "War! We want war!" In response, a large crowd of students answered Talat's declaration with a call for an aggressive attack on Bulgaria's most important cities, saying, "War, we want war. Assault on Plovdiv, assault on Sofia." The next day, the CUP's central organ, Tanin, would state, quote, "There is only one act, one vision that occupies the life and existence of the nation. War, war, war." It is notable that the Dunmay economist Mehmed Javid refused to speak at the demonstration in Istanbul or to publicly call for war. It appeared that Javid was already beginning to move away from the radical unionist line being espoused by Talat Javed's longtime friend and comrade from Salonika. So while Javed continued to hold out hope that a diplomatic solution could be found to save Ottoman Europe, Talat and the majority of Unionists intentionally inflamed the passions of young, angry Ottomans through populist propaganda. On October the 8th, an even bigger demonstration in Istanbul would be led by the CUP. Thousands of young students and other disaffected Muslims marched on the Sublime Porte, singing patriotic songs and shouting, "We want war. Long live war. To hell with Article 23. A reference to the 1878 Treaty of Berlin. Then, apparently, a student then shouted, "The nation wants war, not the dismemberment of the empire nor the abandonment of Macedonia." In the end, the CUP and the patriotic students in Istanbul would get what they wanted. Because that very same day of the demonstration, on October the 8th, 1912, tiny Montenegro declared war on the Ottoman Empire. 9 days later, Bulgaria, who had already engaged in military operations, formally declared war and began moving troops toward the Ottoman border in northern Thrace. A day after that, Serbia and Greece followed suit. So, by October the 18th, all four members of the Balkan League, Greece, Serbia, Bulgaria, and Montenegro, were officially at war with the Ottoman Empire. The combined armies of the Balkan League would crash upon Ottoman Europe like a tidal wave. And to the great surprise of everyone, from the great powers to the leaders of the Ottoman Empire and the Balkan states, and especially to the CUP, the Ottoman armies would be in full-scale retreat within 6 weeks of fighting. The first decisive battle came in late October when the Serbs thrashed the Ottoman Vardar army at the Battle of Kumanovo. Following this victory, the Serbs would capture Skopje, which had briefly fallen into the hands of Albanian rebels mere months earlier, and they then began to march towards Monastir in central Macedonia. Then, on October the 26th, with the Ottoman armies in Macedonia in complete disarray, Greek forces under the Crown Prince Constantine seized the city of Salonika. And just like that, the birthplace of the revolution, home of the CUP's Sacred Committee, the secretive revolutionary cell that had launched the 1908 revolution, was now occupied by a foreign army. Further to the east, the Bulgarians on October the 22nd won a decisive victory at the Battle of Kirk-Kilisse, capturing the town of Kirklareli, a mere 200 kilometers from Istanbul itself. On October the 28th, the Bulgarians once again crushed the Ottoman army at the Battle of Lüleburgaz, in what was one of the largest battles in Europe since the Franco-Prussian War of 1870. Following this defeat, the Ottoman army retreated all the way to the Çatalca Line, a fortified defensive line just 40 kilometers outside the gates of the imperial capital. By the end of November, the onslaught of the Bulgarian army was finally halted at the Battle of Çatalca. This battle also saw brutal fighting, but the Ottoman army managed to hold the line and to prevent the Bulgarians from entering Istanbul. Even as the main Bulgarian forces advanced towards Istanbul, a separate army had already encircled the fortress city of Edirne, also known as Adrianople, and the Bulgarians would then besiege the city. Edirne, the home of Mehmed Talat, would then be put under a grueling siege that would last over 4 months. In late November, while the Bulgarian advance was ongoing, the Serbs would win yet another victory in western Macedonia and would capture the city of Monastir, the home of the revolutionary heroes of liberty, the Albanian Ahmed Niazi, and Ismail Enver. Stuck in Libya fighting the Italians, Enver was forced to watch helplessly as his homeland was conquered by the Serbs. Mustafa Kemal, the future Ataturk, would also have to watch helplessly from Libya as his home of Salonika was taken by the Greeks. Years later, he would reflect on the loss, saying, quote, "I lost my city. The place where I was born was no longer mine." For all intents and purposes, by December 1912, the heartland of Ottoman Europe, Rumelia, had effectively ceased to exist. For over six centuries, Rumelia had been a core component of the empire, dating back to the earliest Ottoman conquests in the Balkans. It was the birthplace of all the major revolutionary leaders of the CUP. And now, after just 6 weeks of fighting, it had fallen to the combined forces of Serbia, Bulgaria, Greece, and Montenegro. In early December, the Ottoman government sued for an armistice with the Balkan League. In late October, amidst the chaos of defeat, the so-called Great Cabinet under the respected war hero Gazi Ahmed Mutar Pasha had resigned and was replaced by a new government led by the liberal Grand Vizier Kamil Pasha. When Kamil's government called for an armistice in December, the liberals in power and the unionists in opposition took diametrically opposed stances on the war. The liberals wanted to sue for peace in order to avoid any further losses and to protect Istanbul from potential Bulgarian occupation. And this was not an abstract fear. It was widely known that Tsar Ferdinand of Bulgaria held ambitions to revive Byzantium, imagining a new Christian Orthodox empire centered not in Sofia, but in Constantinople. Tsar Ferdinand's army now stood just 40 kilometers from the capital. The Unionists, meanwhile, slammed Kamil's government, accusing it of cowardice and of mismanaging the war. Talat and other CUP radicals called for renewed resistance to drive the Balkan armies out and to save Rumelia. Several Ottoman positions were still holding out. The city of Yanina in Epirus was besieged by Greek forces. Shkodër, or Ishkodra, in northern Albania was under pressure from the Montenegrins. But the loudest calls were made to save Edirne, Talat's hometown, still under siege but not yet fallen to the Bulgarians. Amidst this atmosphere of political turmoil and military catastrophe, Ismail Enver would finally make his way back to Istanbul. When word reached Enver in Libya of the invasion of Rumelia, he resolved to return home to defend the empire. But by the time he left Tripoli, the CUP had been purged from government. So Enver, now a revolutionary without a state, had to travel in secret. With the help of CUP contacts, he was first smuggled from Tripoli to Alexandria. Then he boarded a steamer across the Mediterranean, passing through Malta before landing in Brindisi, Italy. From there, he traveled by train through Trieste to Vienna. And finally, with the assistance from Unionist agents in Austria-Hungary, he boarded the Orient Express, riding through enemy territory in Serbia and Bulgaria. He then arrived in Istanbul in disguise, reportedly using an Albanian pseudonym. Upon his arrival in the capital, Enver would say, quote, "I find myself in a totally hostile environment. The whole cabinet, as well as the Minister of War, are being very friendly, but I know they are having me followed by spies." In late December, Enver made several trips to the Çatalca Line, where the Ottoman army had finally managed to halt the Bulgarian advance. There, he became convinced that the Ottomans had the upper hand and that now was the time to launch a counteroffensive to relieve Edirne. He warned, quote, "If the cabinet surrenders Edirne without any effort, I will quit the army, I will openly call for war, and I do not know, or rather don't wish to say, what I might do." Next week, we will get to see what Enver would decide to do, and how he and Talat would set into motion a plan to overthrow the government, seize control of the capital, and to restart the war for Ottoman Rumelia. So, join me next episode for The Raid on the Sublime Porte.